Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of Deckert. We have Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. And I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. In January, the Office of the Inspector General advised the city's Department of Law that it was not cooperating by oversight by refusing to provide recent hiring records to the OIG. And the Department of Law declined in part because it says it was related to a high-profile position. Here to talk with us more about that is the City of Chicago Inspector General, Deborah Witzberg. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So, Inspector General, as Ryan profiled earlier this month, the Office of Inspector General issued its advisory on the Department of Law's cooperation with oversight of its employment actions, which had stemmed from an advisory in January relating to the Department of Law's failure to cooperate with oversight of its employment actions. Tell us more about this report.
Thank you for your interest in this. So by way of a little bit of historical context here, the city of Chicago was for many, many decades involved in litigation and under a consent decree in federal court related to the city's employment practices. This was the Shackman litigation, with which many, many people will be familiar. So there was this long-standing court order to reform the city's employment practices to ensure that they were fair and legal. In 2014, the city argued to the federal court that it should be found in what's called substantial compliance with that court order. That is to say, the city argued that enough had been fixed, it had made enough progress in reforming its hiring practices, that it should be released from this court order. In arguing that to the court, the city, by way of the Department of Law, sort of heralded the fact that going forward, the Office of Inspector General would be overseeing the city's hiring practices, and therefore the court's monitorship was no longer necessary. OIG's authority that the Department of Law heralded to the federal court to oversee the city's employment practices is written into our enabling ordinance. We have specific statutory authority to do just that, to monitor and oversee the city's employment practices. Now, the Department of Law is a city department. They, too, are under our oversight jurisdiction. The Department of Law, like all other city departments, has a legal obligation to cooperate with OIG's work. In two recent situations, which we note in this letter, we requested records from the Department of Law about their own hiring practices, positions that they were hiring for. And the Department of Law, despite having heralded to the federal court the importance of OIG's oversight in this function, declined to provide us with those records. One of the reasons given when they declined to provide the records was that some of them were related to what they called a high-profile position. Now, needless to say, OIG's legal authority to oversee the city's hiring practices and the Department of Law's duty to cooperate with the Office of Inspector General do not contain exceptions for high-profile situations. In fact, when it comes to fostering trust, public trust in government, it seems to me to be the case that it is high-profile situations which are most in need of scrutiny and oversight. When we received this response from the Department of Law when they declined to provide the records, we waited a little while, and then we submitted a covert FOIA request to the Department of Law for those same records. Many employment-related records for city employees are, in fact, public records. They are subject to public release in FOIA. And so we submitted an anonymous and covert FOIA request, and the Department of Law produced the same records which they had refused to provide to us in response to this anonymous FOIA, not knowing, presumably, that we were behind the request. The acknowledgement from the Department of Law eventually that these records were subject even to public release, I think is very hard to reconcile with a good faith rationale for refusing to provide them to OIG. OIG has legal authority to access city records far above and beyond what is subject to public release. these records were in fact public records, which the Department of Law itself eventually acknowledged by producing them in response to this FOIA.
I mean, that's wild. Like, just, I don't know if our listeners and viewers are really going to absorb that. So let's, I mean, it's hard to get your head around. So the general public can get access to this information just by a FOIA request, yet they claim, the Department of Law claimed a privilege over it. What? How do they explain this? Have they explained it? They say, you caught us red-handed? I mean, that seems to be the only possible answer. And my second question is, what is a high-profile position? What does that mean exactly?
I don't know what that means. And this is a little hard to get your head around, for lots of reasons, I think, including that, right, the Department of Law itself went before the federal court and said, we don't need to be under the oversight of the court because OIG has authority to monitor all of the city's employment practices. And then they declined to provide us records, to which we are entitled. And then, despite having refused to provide them to OIG, they then acknowledge that they're subject to public release. That is a little bit baffling. And I think, frankly, that one way to understand these events is something you've heard me say before, which is that if something walks and talks like hostility to oversight, sometimes it's just hostility to oversight. And I think it is very hard to understand this sequence of events as anything other than that.
So in response to the advisory, the law department acknowledged that your office has the authority to monitor its employment actions under the employment plan, but yes, didn't explain why they withheld these records. And the mayor's office also responded. Can you comment on that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's right. The law department responded, acknowledging the very same legal authority which they had trumpeted before the federal court, but did not offer an explanation for why they refused to provide these records to OIG. In fact, their response really only speaks to an inconsistency between their response to OIG and a response to a FOIA request, which from my perspective misses the point of the advisory and of our recommendation, which was that the Department of Law meet its legal obligations to cooperate with our oversight. The mayor's office did also respond, as you know. We published the mayor's office response as well. And I should say here, the mayor's office was not under any obligation to respond. Our letter was addressed to the law department, and we included the mayor's office on the letter sort of as a courtesy as much as anything else. And I appreciate the mayor's office having responded despite their not having been obligated to do so. The mayor's office response notes that our letter was the first time they were aware of the law department's refusal to provide the records. And in that response, which was signed by the mayor's chief of staff, she writes that the mayor's office had asked the law department to ensure its appropriate compliance, you know, that the matter was handled appropriately going forward.
Last question, Inspector General. This is your last time on Legal Face-Off, presumably, as Inspector General. You've been a great guest. Your term ends in April. You know, we often hear from one presidential administration to another, they often leave a little note, right? One president leaves a note or some staff.
In the red little desk.
Yeah, in the desk. Although Trump famously failed to do so. Number one, what would be your note to your successor? Number two, what's your plan? We've asked you several times to break some news here on Legal Face-Off about your future. Mayor, senator, what's going on in your
president.
Future? President, of course, all of these things.
All good ideas. No breaking news today. I have said before, I continue to say, I'm not done with public service. I hope public service isn't done with me. But no breaking news today. In terms of advice, you know, I it's been a tremendous privilege to serve in this job, and I am deeply hopeful for the success of the next person lucky enough to do the job. I'm not sure I have a ton of good advice, except maybe to say that in this job, as I think in many others, I think it's important to pick your battles and to win the ones you pick.
All right. So last time we'll be able to say this, Inspector General Deborah Witzberg, thank you so much. Maybe next time we'll call you University President or Network Meteorologist or Billionaire Entrepreneur Deborah Witzberg. We'll see.
All good ideas.
Yeah, I like it. Thanks so much for coming on. Don't forget about us at Legal Face-Off.
Thank you so much.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. There's a lawsuit that claims Doge used ChatGPT to tag Jewish-themed grants as DEI, then canceled them. Eugene Volokh is a Thomas M. Sybil Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and spent more than 30 years as a professor of law at UCLA School of Law. Professor, thanks so much for talking with us about this.
Very much my pleasure. My understanding of the lawsuit, at least if it's the one that I was just reading just now, is that the Doge action was not aimed at Jewish-themed material as such, but a broader range of race, ethnicity, sex, sexual orientation-themed material, and that Jewish material was included on that theory. It may still be impermissible, but I don't think, at least not the allegations that I've seen, don't suggest that Jewish-themed material was deliberately targeted, but simply because it was Jewish, without singling out Jewish material only and nothing else. I don't think that's what's happened.
Well, we had long heard about the Doge efforts in terms of trying to, you know, fix DEI efforts. We had long heard that they were basing their judgment and decisions on some really strange criteria. For example, removing, you know, references to the Enola Gay because they thought that was, you know, a homosexual reference. This case has brought to light, at least allegedly, some of those efforts. And the allegation of this lawsuit is that the Doge was using ChatGPT to try to figure out DEI practices. And in this case, they were focusing on issues like the Association of Jewish Studies and use of, you know, Jewish film and so forth. What's the legal issue involved here, though?
Right. So there are at least two separate questions we can consider. One is, can the government cancel contracts because it thinks that they are focused too much on diversity, equity, and inclusion and related viewpoints? Can the government cancel such contracts, or perhaps can it decide to enter or not enter into such contracts based on their viewpoint? There's a separate question, which is, if it decides to do that, if it's allowed to do that, can it do it using AI selection criteria, which may be over and under inclusive? Or is that too arbitrary, too imprecise a way of doing that? Those are two separate questions. As to the second, my sense is that by itself, use of AI to do these kinds of things is not impermissible. That the main legal objections are, however they choose to do it, whether using AI or not, however they choose to do it, it's impermissible for them to cancel these contracts based on viewpoint. Now, that question itself turns on or includes a bunch of different issues. One issue is these are grants, projects that were already funded. Can you cancel them retroactively, as opposed to just say we're not going to enter into them into the future? That's an interesting question. I'm not an expert on that. That has to do more sense with contract law. It would require looking at the particular terms of the grants and such. A second question, which is a First Amendment question, is can the government engage in viewpoint discrimination in awarding grants to the National Endowment for Humanities, let's say, or not awarding them or canceling them? A third question is it impermissible discrimination based on race or ethnicity or perhaps religion if they target things related to, let's say, Black history, Jewish history, and the like? So those are all separate questions, and the courts are going to have to deal with them separately.
So, Professor, what is your view in terms of labeling, whether labeling something as DEI and then defunding it, whether it creates a viewpoint discrimination problem under the First Amendment?
Right. So this turns out to be a surprisingly complicated and unresolved question. On the one hand, the court has in the past said that grant making can't be done based on viewpoint, at least when it involves invidious, whatever that term might mean here, viewpoint discrimination. That was in a case involving the National Endowment for the Arts. On the other hand, one would think that the government could say, look, you know, we want to fund a wide range of projects, but we don't want to fund racist projects. Let's forget about the DEI stuff. Just if somebody says, here's this project where I want to prove the superiority of this race or that race or this ethnicity or that ethnicity, we just don't want to fund that because that's not a viewpoint that we think is worthy of being supported by the government. That's a viewpoint-based distinction, but you'd think the government would be allowed to do that, allowed to say that in this discretionary selection system, we just don't want to include those. Likewise, my understanding is that certainly various government entities, whether perhaps past administrations or state grant-making entities or perhaps a local school board or university, have had preferences for DEI-themed material. I've said, you know, we want to fund more stuff that's related to DEI. One factor in your application might be, does it discuss issues related to diversity, equity, and inclusion? And that probably means discuss in the way we like it. So that, if that's allowed, that would suggest that viewpoint discrimination in this kind of discretionary grant making isn't really that bad. So that's going to be one of the questions that the courts are going to resolve. As I said, in the NEA context, as to art, the Supreme Court did say that while the government can decide, obviously based on content, what kind of art to fund, it doesn't have to just randomly pick proposals, it's not allowed to engage in invidious viewpoint discrimination, maybe hostile or viewpoint. We don't know exactly what it meant by that. And that's a pretty strong argument as to the National Endowment for Humanities fundings here. But again, if that argument prevails, that suggests that future administrations could be sued for declining to fund material that they see as racist or sexist or homophobic or whatever else. And I'm not sure if courts are going to be on board with that.
I mean, what is constitutional about it? I mean, at the risk of, you know, oversimplifying it, what is the unconstitutional part of targeting viewpoints or identities?
Well, so the First Amendment bars the government from restricting freedom of speech. Now, what does that mean? Well, the court has for a long time said, well, certainly the government can't, sometimes it can restrict speech, let's say, true threats of violence or defamation, false statements that damage people's reputation. But surely it can't restrict this based on viewpoint. The whole point of the First Amendment is that citizens or ordinary Americans should pick and choose what viewpoints they agree with and not that the government is trying to shield them from certain viewpoints. Well, one question is, how much does that apply when it comes to government funding? And the answer is sometimes the government can't discriminate based on viewpoint. So, for example, with the charitable tax exemption, all sorts of educational nonprofits are entitled to that charitable tax exemption. The government can't say, well, if you're racist, we will deny you the tax exemption. That's pretty clear. The Supreme Court has said that because that's something that's really available to absolutely, not absolutely everybody, but let's say to a very, very wide range of applicants under objective criteria. You can't discriminate then based on viewpoint, even though it has to do with government funds, because tax exemptions are kind of like a subsidy. At the other end of the spectrum, let's say the government is deliberately funding some program to convey a government message. join the military. It doesn't have to equally fund messages that say, don't join the military, right? The government can fund messages that say, can fund studies that study how to deal with global warming. And if somebody applies, says, well, I want to show that there is no global warming, or the global warming is not a real problem. Well, the government can say we don't have to fund that, because that's our speech, even if we engage in it using using grants to other people. So what about kind of intermediate things, things that are not the government speech, like NEA-provided art, NEH-provided projects, are generally not the government itself having that message as such. But on the other hand, it's also not something that's sort of even-handedly open to all applicants. It involves some sort of judgment based on quality. And the question is, can the government consider viewpoint as one element of that quality-based judgment?
So, Professor, one last question, last 30 seconds. Can you comment on the AI element here?
Like,
it doesn't present just a tool here, or are there separate legal issues that are involved with respect to the AI portion here?
Yeah, I'm inclined to say that if it's okay to discriminate based on viewpoint in grants or in cancellation of grants, it's okay to use AI to try to do the first screening. And even if that means it's a little bit over and under inclusive, you know, that's often going to happen in a large bureaucratic system. Now, I suppose somebody could say, well, you can only use it for the first screening, but then there has to be a human judgment as to whether indeed it fits within within the viewpoint criteria that you use, so that you correct whatever mistakes AI may make. You might argue that somehow arbitrary and capricious just to rely on AI here. Maybe, although there are benefits to relying to automated systems as well. But I think the real question is it okay to engage in such viewpoint discrimination? If it's not, then you can't do it with AI. If it is, then you probably could do it with AI.
Professor Eugene Volek, thank you so much for coming on Legal Face-Off with us.
Very much my pleasure. Thank you.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to Legal Face-Off on WGNradio.com. A class action lawsuit's been filed against David Protein Bars, claiming they're loaded with fat and calories. Diana Winters is deputy director of the Resnick Center for Food Law and Policy at UCLA Law. Thank you so much for coming on with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Diana, earlier this month, a class action lawsuit was filed, as Ryan profiled, alleging that David Protein Bars are misbranded under FDA guidelines and that the nutritional content of the bars is being misrepresented. Can you tell us a little bit more about this case?
Sure. I mean, very simply, the plaintiffs are alleging that the defendant company failed to provide a statement of a correct number of calories and the correct number of fats. So basically saying that by doing this, they're violating federal law, but they're actually suing under state law. It's an interesting nuance. They're saying you violated federal law, and that means you actually violated state law.
So plaintiffs are saying that they sent the bars to an independent lab for testing and that the fats and calories were, I think the numbers were like 268 and 275, way more than they were advertised per bar. David has responded that the measurement methods are inaccurate. What are your thoughts on these competing allegations?
It's interesting. There's a central scientific dispute. It's going to come down to experts. It has to do with this key ingredient. I don't even want to try to pronounce it, but it's EPG, which is a modified plant-based oil. FDA has looked at multiple notices saying that the body digests this kind of oil differently than other oils, that not all of it is absorbed. And that's what David Protein says. So it says, hey, we're right. The way you're measuring this, plaintiffs, is the old way to measure it for a different kind of ingredient. And they're saying, no, but you're not complying with FDA guidelines. So the question is, do I have FDA guidelines kept up with novel ingredients? Are they actually, which side is actually measuring it right? And who can prove it to the satisfaction of a judge and or a jury.
Diana, I just want to follow up because as someone who reads nutrition labels very carefully, I was blown away by this idea. I didn't know this. So in this case, the allegation is that these bars exceeded the advertisement by 83% and 400%. But this is the part that blew my mind. Apparently, FDA regulations allow these labels to actually exceed the value by 20%. That to me seems crazy. I mean, so you have up to 19% lying, according to the federal government, and that's okay? So actually, everything I'm looking at, it could be 90% higher, and that's allowed under the federal government. How is that possible?
I think maybe we as consumers rely too much on scientific accuracy. I think what FDA is saying here is that possibly wiggle room of even 20% is necessary, that we can't get that close to a specific number. But I agree with you. 20% seems like a lot. Like we often see things like, hey, if it's under 5 grams or under five calories different, you can read it as zero. Or you have 5 milligrams of trans fat, you can say that zero or something along those lines. I'm not saying exact numbers here, but the 20% seems like a lot. I agree with you.
So, Diana, David owes a lot of its success to a viral following. And there have been a flurry of social media posts about the lawsuit since it was filed from both sides, both the plaintiffs as well and people who are supportive of the plaintiffs as well as David Protein Bars. There have been references to Regina George from Mean Girls. There's been references to the Seinfeld episode that was about the non-fat yogurt that made everybody gain weight. Given the age that we're in, what impact do you think the social media posts and followings will have on not only this case and others like it?
It's huge. I mean, social media cuts both ways. It puts this reputational pressure on the defendant. It can help build the class. You saw that this complaint was filed as a class action. They're saying that these specific plaintiffs represent a much larger class of people who are harmed by this. On the other hand, it flattens nuance. I mean, here we've got a genuine scientific dispute here and a question of measuring novel ingredients and how our body absorbs protein and fat and calories. And it's really hard to get that across through social media. It's interesting. FDA needs to get on top of social media as well. That's something else it's behind on regulating, but it'll be interesting to watch.
We're entering, I think, our 11th year. It seems like every other show, if not every month, we cover a story in our grab bag segment about these kind of lawsuits, alleging that the consumers the public is being defrauded by allegations that these companies are making. They're exaggerating, they're lying. You know, newsflash, strawberry Pop-Tarts aren't real strawberries, you know? Cereal isn't made from real fruit. Maybe a foot long is not actually exactly 12 feet. What's going on with all of these lawsuits? What's the reason behind them? Are people being more litigious or just we hearing more about them? Are companies paying more? What are your thoughts on this trend that we're talking about?
There's definitely been an increase in these lawsuits over the last decade or so. Again, it cuts both ways. Like on one hand, these lawsuits are helping to fill the gap where regulation really hasn't addressed certain things, if FDA is behind in certain things. For example, there's no federal definition of the word natural. So people have litigated that. Companies have backed off from using natural when they're actually using ingredients that the regular consumer wouldn't think are natural. On the other hand, the rise in these lawsuits have led to a lot of settlements where smaller companies just don't have the money to litigate it. And that may not be a good thing. I think companies may be able to, and they're starting to realize that they have to get ahead of this kind of stuff by being proactive, by thinking about the reasonable consumer, about stress testing their own labels, and thinking about transparency. And so it goes both ways, but you're right. There has been an increase in these lawsuits.
To what extent, Diana, do you think the definition of a reasonable consumer has changed? Because it seems like a lot of these lawsuits are being filed where some of them are, you know, I think, you know, potentially meritorious, but others, people are making allegations that we just didn't see a number of years ago where they just seem like they're really off the wall. Do you care to comment on that?
The definition of reasonable consumer is contested across the country. And right now we're seeing courts grappling with just exactly that issue. And especially in, as you pointed out, the age of social media, the age of smartphones, like everybody has so much access to so much information. Has the reasonable consumer changed? On the other hand, we're inundated by products in the supermarket. No one has 7 hours to shop for their family and to read everything and to check QR codes. So you're struggling. Everybody's struggling with that question. It's very interesting.
Well, I measure every foot-long sandwich I get. I am a reasonable consumer. Diana Winters, thank you so much for coming on with us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at Deckard LLP and global co-chair of the firm's intellectual property practice. She has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers and Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. For more than 150 years, Deckard has advised the innovators who move industries forward. From the railroad pioneers of the 19th century to the world's top asset managers today, Deckard helps leaders uncover opportunity and unlock advantage. If you would like to learn more about Christina Martini and Deckard, visit Deckard.com.
It's time for the legal grab bag. We're joined this week by Brian Rosenblatt of Downey & Lenkoff in beautiful Chicago, Illinois, and Christopher Fusco, founding partner and managing partner of Callahan & Fusco. He's also been a legal analyst on numerous networks, including Fox News, MSNBC, Court TV, even the MLB Network. Wow, there you go.
Not bad. He's
based in New Jersey. Thank you both so much for coming on. All right, let's start here. A federal judge ended the Justice Department's criminal probe into Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell and his Senate testimony on the central bank's renovations. Rich, what does all this mean?
I mean, not only this kind of got lost, honestly, like in the fog of war the last couple of weeks, but yeah, it was also, I think, on Friday when this came down, but really significant because it's just another example of a federal court judge literally, like in no uncertain terms, just excoriating the DOJ and the Trump administration for some of the wackiest legal theories we've seen. We've covered the story before, but basically, Tina, you know, Trump went after through the DOJ Fed Chair Powell because he's on a vendetta against Powell. He wants him to lower interest rates. He wants to fire him. He's called him stupid, idiot, all these names that Trump does. There was that famous awkward video of the two of them standing together. When he realized that he can neither fire him nor force him to resign, he decided to go after him legally on these ridiculous charges stemming from, you know, Powell overseeing a renovation of the building, which, you know, I think anyone would admit it went over budget, but Trump, of course, lied about the renovations. That's what prompted that video. Powell corrected him on video, but he went after him because of incompetence in overseeing this project and also allegedly lying under oath when he testified before Congress. Well, this federal court judge said that it was garbage, basically, that there was no actual legal basis to go after Powell. This was merely a pretense brought by Trump because he wanted to force lower interest rates and also force Powell out. And it was brought by, you know, Trump appointee, former Fox News host Judge Jeanine Pirro, who, of course, came out and said, I'm going to appeal it. And this was an activist judge, the whole playbook, right? It's always an activist judge. It's always we're going to appeal. These appeals sound great and they never go anywhere. So I'm glad that the judge who was appointed by Obama went this way and, again, in no uncertain terms, said how nonsensical this legal theory and this vendetta was.
Yeah, Rich, summarized nicely, I'd say, you know, this is the playbook and this is not the first. It's not going to be the last. And, you know, usually these things are filed, hit the press when there's something else bigger going on. As you said here, we've been at war the last 2 weeks. Now, granted, this was filed a while ago, but, you know, all to say that a lot of these things that we see hitting the press is when there's other things going on. It's usually the nothing to see here sort of philosophy, right?
And it really is a big deal, Chris, because like the successor to Powell has been held up because, you know, Republican Tom Tillis, who has been a vocal critic, by the way, on his way out of Congress. No surprise that these guys, you know, grow some stones when they have no reelection. He's held up. He said he won't vote on the successor until this is resolved. So been a bit of a standoff. But, you know, this is actually big things. But in no country in the world, it's kind of an accepted principle before Trump, not only in the U.S., but in every country, that the central bank and the government should be complete separate entities. Trump, of course, has thrown that all away.
Yeah, you know, Rich, I was thinking, because I was a prosecutor for 6 years. I was a DA in Brooklyn, and I actually have indicted hundreds of defendants and had many grand jury subpoenas issued. I've never got a no-true bill as a prosecutor, and I've never had a subpoena quashed or been denied by a judge. You really have to work at it. So I had to go back and look at the standard of it's got to be oppressive or just completely unreasonable. It's so unusual. I think that's, if people take one thing out of it, just how unusual it is to have no true bills being voted out by grand juries and subpoenas being quashed. It's really not the way things usually go. And you can forget the whole Bush or Obama appointee. Federal judges are usually very kind to federal prosecutors, and they're not in the business of getting rid of their subpoenas. So this is a very strange outcome. It just tells you that the whole thing stinks.
Yeah, Brian, the judge said, and again, these words are, it's really important always to read these words. The president spent years essentially asking if no one will rid him of this troublesome Fed chair. He then suggested a specific line of investigation into him. The president's appointed prosecutor promptly complied. Like in any other time in history, this would be the most egregious thing a sitting president did. It would end his career. Of course, this is like a blip on the radar in Trump legal world.
Yeah, I don't care for bullies in the first place, but you know, I strongly believe governmental departments and entities, they need to be able to operate without interference or threats. If there's a legitimate allegation against Powell, it should be explored. But absent that, I agree that the court's decision to quash the subpoenas is justified. But even with that, you know, the U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro, she immediately came out and said that we're going to appeal this decision. And I guess my question is, we're in mid-March right now. Powell's term as chair of the Fed expires in May. If they appeal, does that prolong his time in this position until it gets resolved? And at a certain point, doesn't common sense tell you, let it go and we'll just have the next person in?
That's a great point. All right. Live Nation and Ticketmaster remain a hot couple after reaching a settlement with the DOJ. Rich, what'll this mean for the price of Bruce Springsteen tickets?
Unfortunately, not much. I hate
Chris
to
gets
say
to pay
it.
More.
Yeah, we were just talking offline about the cost of Springsteen, which we all love, and Harry Styles set records. Harry Styles has, what, a 30-night residency at MSG coming up. Really, the highest market ever for tickets. And this lawsuit that was brought by the DOJ was meant to deal with that. I mean, basically, this gained steam after millions of people were shut out of the Eras Tour, the Taylor Swift concert a couple of years ago. That set blew away records for concert attendance. That prompted this lawsuit, which basically alleged that Ticketmaster and Live Nation, which merged many years ago, were violating the Sherman Act and created a monopoly, Tina, because not only were they dominating the sale market, they were dominating the resale market. They were advertising. They were promoting. They were controlling the venues. This was, it sounded like, to the layperson, a monopoly. Well, this case settled last Monday, and the court basically entered into the parties entered into agreement. At the end of the day, they didn't bust up this alleged monopoly. That's the key takeaway. What they did do is they created a fund. I think it was $200 million, which is like a rounding error for this company, basically. It's not a lot of money to be distributed to the states. It allowed other competitors, I guess this is important, but we'll, you know, it depends on how it's really enforced, allow competitors like SeatGeek, StubHub, these other companies to get involved in these shows and potentially create more of a free market to help consumers. But, you know, I don't, it also created some more transparency over ticket fees, which everyone hates, right? It doesn't sound like it'll change much because Ticketmaster is still going to dominate the market. The states, there was like 40 or so states that also sued. Those states remain alive. Many of the attorney generals have said that despite the settlement, they're going to continue to pursue litigation. We'll see how that goes. But you also can't take the politics away, you know, out of this, of course, because, Trump has come out and said that he wants to be involved in all these decisions and has been involved. We saw that in the, you know, Netflix, losing the Warner deal. So we'll see, to our earlier point, if this results in lower prices for us all.
Yeah, Rich, I do think that this is just a little bit too early to make that final call. But a couple things, I do think that this is a direct result of the political environment we're in. I also think, though, and this is something that those of us who sort of watch antitrust issues, to do a breakup of this, you know, entity at this stage of the game, after so many years of them being joined up, that is a really big deal. And so I really think that more often than not, you don't see that happening, although it was a possibility here. I can't say I'm surprised that it didn't happen.
Yeah, Brian, the DOJ, you know, approved the merger back in 2010. Kind of the degree to which the federal government sometimes waxes and wanes. Again, sometimes that depends on who's in office. This, you know, particular administration has been aggressive in some ways, but not in this particular case.
Yeah, I still don't understand how in 2010 the merger was approved and wasn't deemed monopolistic at that time, because it did shut out so many competitors, and it was the only ticketing platform, the only viable ticketing platform out there. This settlement, which wasn't reported to Judge Subramanian timely, apparently, is supposed to, well, Ticketmaster is supposed to have a standalone ticketing system now to allow SeatGeek and StubHub to offer tickets to others. They're calling this an open source model. It doesn't address whether or not Ticketmaster will still be able to sell and divert tickets to those third-party vendors in the first place. Ticketmaster is supposed to divest itself of 13 separate amphitheaters. We don't know whether that means that they are going to divest ownership of the amphitheaters or simply the exclusive ticketing rights to them. 50% of the tickets are going to be for non-exclusive venues. There's no definition as to what that means. Ticketmaster said they will cap ticket service fees at 15%. The question is, what other fees are then going to be tacked on, whether there's delivery fees or there's administration fees, because it's not just a one category catch-all. And it's interesting that, you know, Mike Rapino, Ticketmaster's CEO, his statement was, "We've never relied on exclusivity to drive our ticketing business. It has simply been the result of having the best products, services, and people in the industry." And to be fair, they do a tremendous job with ticketing and live venues and whatnot. But to say that they don't rely on exclusivity is kind of a little bit disingenuous. They are the big dog. They are the primary producer out there. And it's easy to say that, well, that's not why we're so good. But it's easy to force others out of the market when you are that big.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good point. And some of it, Chris, is chicken or egg. I mean, anyone who's bought tickets through Ticketmaster, you know, I just bought some tickets on Sunday. It was a pretty seamless process considering how, you know, much is involved. Like I bought from Ticketmaster's secondary website. I'm actually getting tickets from someone else who originally bought them. They got a I mean, that's a lot of logistics, and Ticketmaster does it within seconds. And then, you know, if the tickets don't show up. So, I mean, there is some value to that. I think the biggest point in the defense of Ticketmaster and Live Nation, which they brought up, is that they're not setting the prices. They're merely a conduit for the artist. Much like, you know, DoorDash is not setting the price of your chicken parm. They're just delivering it. it's really the musicians. If anyone is greedy, it's the musicians, goes the argument. And I think that's true. I mean, the musicians at any time, the artists could any time say, we want to cap our prices at $100. And, you know, Ticketmaster could charge 15% on top of that. But that doesn't get to $3,000. At the end of the day, I agree with Live Nation that if you're mad at someone, be mad at Springsteen, Harry Styles, etc.
Well, we can't be mad at Springsteen.
Of course.
We know that. We know that. We're putting that on the side because he's, you know, I'm from New Jersey, so I have no choice. But if you don't break the relationship with Ticketmaster and the venues, this is what you said. This is a rounding error. It's the exclusivity they have with the venues. That's what this really comes down to. Why is every big concert on Ticketmaster? Because they have the exclusive deals with Brooklyn and Madison Square Garden and the venues that you live in. And that's what's going on here. And it does hurt the consumer. But you're right, Rich. I don't see the artist necessarily saying, you know, I can't stand to have $3,000 a floor seat. I don't see that either. So,
but what's wrong? But to your point, what's wrong with exclusivity? That's the market. Why should the government step in and interfere with the free market? If Ticketmaster wasn't doing a good job, then they wouldn't be around. Consumers wouldn't, you know, pay what they're paying. As long as consumers are willing to pay, then that's fine, in my opinion.
Well, yes and no. The problem is, yes, it's always what the market will bear. But the difference now is that, you know, when Springsteen used to play in New Jersey, so he played at the old Giant Stadium, it was like a block party. Everybody you knew from New Jersey is there. And now with Ticketmaster and exclusivity and the algorithms and dynamic pricing, it gets more and more difficult for fans to go to shows. I mean, you can shrug your shoulders and say that's okay.
That's the market. That's the market. But that's the free market.
You know, sometimes one's enough's enough. It's like anything else. It's not just concerts. It's like taking a family to go see a baseball game or a football game is so expensive now. You got to wonder when's enough's enough.
Brian, you got something real quick?
Just real quickly, that there's one other aspect in play here. Aside from the exclusivity, and that is customer frustration over the high prices. It largely stems from the unregulated secondary ticket market, which is a separate issue from the merger itself. And that would never have been addressed by a breakup. It's some of the ticket brokers, ticket scalpers, if you will, the modern day scalpers, the StubHub, SeatGeek, whatever system it is, they're unregulated. They can charge whatever they want. And that's helping force the prices through the roof.
So I just did a look up for Springsteen. So he'll be in New Jersey and in Chicago in April. In Chicago, you're paying $234 for the nosebleeds. In Jersey, you're paying $248, so a little bit more expensive in Jersey. But flip it on the floor seats. You guys were saying $3,000, $1,600 for floor in Chicago, just $1,000 in Jersey. So scoop them up, I guess, in Jersey if you want to go see Bruce Springsteen.
I think Rich has three pairs ready to go.
There you go. It's because he's bringing right?
I mean,
he's bringing us all.
Fusco knows it's pit or nothing.
Yeah, exactly. I see Rich before, and then he goes and does the, he goes in the pit.
All right, let's stay in the entertainment world. Katy Perry sued Katy Perry, and Katy Perry won. Tina's got more on this trademark battle.
So yeah, Ryan, so this is for all of our listeners in Australia. We bring a trademark case in Australia involving a designer from Australia named Katy Perry with an IE against the pop star Katy Perry with a Y in a case that went on for many years. And so the final decision is that there is no likelihood of confusion between the two Katy Perrys. This all started many years ago when the Katy Perry from Australia started a clothing brand, which was back in 2007. She sued the singer Katy Perry a couple of years ago for selling merchandise during a 2014 Australian tour, alleging that there was a likelihood of confusion between the singer Katy Perry selling merchandise that included clothing and that was going to cause confusion with the Australian Katy Perry's clothing line. That ruling was overturned in 2024 and resulted in the Australian clothing designer's trademark being canceled. But the High Court in Australia just found that the singer's reputation was so well established in Australia that anybody seeing the clothing brand would not confuse the two. As a result, the Australian clothing designer, her trademark remains on the register. There are still issues apparently that the Katy Perry, the singer, wants to resolve and has been sent back to court. But Rich, we've been talking about a lot of trademark issues. This one was really interesting for a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, you've got a clothing designer that claims that she came along before the merchandising by the singer. In trademark land, we call this reverse confusion, when the person that comes along after the initial user actually essentially overwhelms the original user of a brand. And secondly, when you talk about names and using people's names in the context of trademarks, that can be really interesting and it can cut both ways. As we see with things like Wilson Sporting Goods, you can't be named Wilson and try to sell sporting goods under that name, even though that may be your surname. So this also, you know, addresses the interesting issues of people's names in the context of being used as trademarks.
I mean, let's face it, this case really comes down to the sad realities. We're running out of damn names as a society. I mean, there's nothing left, you know? I mean, usually I think, you know, these cases are junk, and usually the underdog, I think, is looking for a fast payday to prey on the identity of the more popular person. In this case, I think it's a little closer. I mean, although I think, you know, anyone who really confuses these two names, I mean, it's just the names are spelled differently, and that's everything, right? I mean, Katie with an I, E versus Katie, I don't see how you would be confused. And just because the singer sells apparel at her concert, that's not her main line of business. I mean, she's a singer. Every singer sells, you know, merch. So I don't think that's really very confusing to the average consumer. I think it's such a small, percentage of people that would actually be confused that it makes the lawsuit a little silly. But it's maybe closer than some of the other nonsense we've seen. Brian, this is your neighborhood. What do you think?
Yeah, when we talk about trademarks, trademark registrations, applications, whatnot, the trademarks are registered within certain classifications of goods and services that have to describe what you're doing. So you could have a McDonald's restaurant and a McDonald's hardware store, which are not in conflict with each other, or a McDowell's, if you like the Golden Arch. Right? But it's interesting that the singer, Katy Perry, in her registration, disclaimed clothing lines. Her application actually says that we're not claiming any clothing lines. So for her to then come back and say that the designer is infringing upon her trademark is a little bit, again, I like this word, disingenuous. It just doesn't ring true. And you're exactly right, Rich. There are different revenue streams. And ultimately, anyone who looks at the designs of the designer versus the merch that the singer was selling, you couldn't possibly confuse the two. It's just not in the same realm.
By the way, I just want to point out that Katy Perry once had a cat named Kitty Purry. So,
and she has a clothing line named Kitty Purry as well, which is
there you go. The cat died in 2020, so. Pour one out for Katy Perry. All right,
are we actually going to leave the segment without mentioning who Katy Perry's current boyfriend is?
Let's do it. Do you want to roll out? Do it? Go ahead.
I mean, the former prime minister of the greatest country on earth, Canada, yeah. Justin Trudeau. That's the power couple of the world right now.
She's been to space. She's dating Canadians. What can you? She's on top of the world.
We will toast with Tim Hortons at their wedding.
There you go.
A former New York Jets linebacker is charged with murdering his girlfriend. And Rich, the evidence includes questions he actually asked to ChatGPT.
This guy's charged with first degree murder in his girlfriend's death. This was in Tennessee, and evidence came out. I mean, this is just more. We cover these stories all the time. It's just categorized under the, you know, stupidest criminals in history. We don't know if this guy did it, but we do know, at least if this is true, that he was searching ChatGPT. So we've moved, Tina, from searching the internet and searching Google for, like, how I could dismember my wife, to now using ChatGPT for a much more effective way to secure your own conviction, right? If there was any doubt before, now is a really efficient way to tell the jury, not only did I do it, I'm stupid enough to ask ChatGPT questions like, now she's messed up. I wake up and she has two swollen eyes. By the way, I didn't do anything, ChatGPT. It was self-inflicted, ChatGPT. She stabbed herself. And then things like, and then ChatGPT says things like, here's what to do. Here's the safest way to handle it without framing it as police trouble. So there's this conversation that's going on between this dummy and ChatGPT. And the allegation is that, of course, this is evidence of his guilt, which seems unsurmountable, in my opinion, but also raises questions, as we seem to cover in every show, Tina, is to what degree does AI have responsibility to step in, alert police, do something except, you know, encourage crazy people for doing crazy things, right? Everything from school shooters to people like this are asking ChatGPT how to do bad things. And does ChatGPT or other AI products have a responsibility to do something?
Well, then there's also the, this guy clearly hasn't listened or watched Legal Face Off, because if he had, he would have realized that using ChatGPT for such activities is not a good idea. You know, and also just the queries were like, you know, essentially he was saying to ChatGPT, if I were to use this as a made up defense that she had slipped and fell and punctured this and broke that, you know, how effective of a made up defense would that be? I mean, these queries really are pretty incriminating. And I agree with you. This just continues the dialogue about at what point are these AI tools supposed to throw up a flag of sorts, right?
Chris, if you were on this jury, would you believe the argument that, no, I wasn't asking for me, I was asking for a friend, the old asking for a friend, how to cover up this murder?
Yeah, first of all, this is why I'm a Giants fan, because, you know, the Jets.
This is the Jetsiest story ever.
You know, anything can happen. But yes, it reeks of consciousness of guilt, and it is really very, very disturbing that at no point that the AI function doesn't say, I'm not doing this anymore. You need to call 911. You need to call the police. I have to stop here. I'm not going to give you an alibi. I'm not going to tell you how to do this a different way. That's really very, very disappointing on so many levels.
It's a great point. And Brian, like if chat, I mean, listen, this technology has been around for like 15 years. We know anytime you get a suggestion when you search for something, that technology has been around forever. So why could my algorithm, if I search dog food, suggest a dog sitter or other dog products, but chat couldn't alert the police? Like, that seems so basic to Chris's point.
Yeah, I don't get too much into the ethics behind AI. I think there's a whole lot there. But the whole story just reeks of the film Basic Instinct, in which Sharon Stone is the author who writes about different murders and then is accused of murdering somebody in the exact way that she wrote about. And, you know, her line is something along the lines of, well, wouldn't I be pretty stupid to commit the same murder that I just wrote about? Perhaps the football player is a little bit brighter. Maybe he's thinking, gosh, wouldn't it be silly for me to do this? I don't know, but it strikes me that there's a question. How much do we want Big Brother reading our emails? How much do we want Big Brother monitoring, just, you know, our online presence?
Just don't uncross your legs, Ryan, in front of the camera. And Fusco, I just have a question. Stupider move by next jet, this guy or Sanchez in Indianapolis a few months ago?
Oh, definitely Sanchez, because he's getting sued left and right. He's going to have to pay a fortune for that. And he lost his job on CBS, too. So, you know, actually, well, I was surprised about Sanchez. I was surprised. But if you want to, who you definitely don't want on the jury for this guy is any jet season ticket holders, because they're going to be really mad. So, you know, they're going to be high-fiving each other when they say guilty.
Well,
so
enjoy Justin Fields.
Exactly.
And team number five.
Exactly. I mean, the Giants in bed for a decade, but we're feeling better now.
By the way, didn't a former NFL football player once write a book called If I Did It?
Exactly. Imagine what he could do with, imagine what OJ could do with ChatGPT.
Right. All right. How wholesome can a fig bar be when it's loaded with bad stuff? Tina, we kind of got into this with Diana on a little bit of a similar topic, but now we get to talk about this with the group.
Yes. So this is an interesting story for the very reason you mentioned, Ryan, that we talked about protein bars earlier in the show, and now we're talking about fig bars. So The it's a New Yorker who filed last week a proposed class action against the company Nature's Bakery that makes fig bars. There are a few issues that the plaintiff has raised. First of all, the name of the company, Nature's Bakery. He also claims that with the use of certain slogans that they're representing that their products are natural and don't contain synthetic ingredients, when they do in fact include a food flavoring and preservative additive called synthetic citric acid. They also use slogans like equal parts wholesome and delicious, and also claims that the products have wholesome baked in. When you take a look at synthetic citric acid, apparently it's in a lot of things, and it's used in a bunch of foods, but it's it actually is created using industrial chemicals, and the ingredient is derived from mold, apparently. When you look at the sugar content of the fig bars, it's actually 14 grams of added sugar per fig bar, which is extraordinarily high. So there are allegations that these bars can actually contribute to creating conditions such as type 2 diabetes and other types of diseases such as cardiovascular and metabolic disease. The accusations, Rich, are what we typically see in these cases, a breach of false advertising and deceptive trade practice laws, and claims that it's false advertising that's misleading and deceptive marketing. I'm not so sure this one is as clear cut as the one we were talking about earlier in the show, because these words, I think, you know, a lot of these are not regulated by the FDA, although there have been some cases recently involving use of the words like wholesome. So they're definitely getting more attention. And I do think it's one of those things that the FDA needs to revisit regulating these types of terms, because there's more litigation involving them now.
I'm surprised that, you know, Nature's Bakery didn't want to market this product using the term mold or autism with new autism. I think this is, you know, listen, as our expert pointed out earlier, like the reason we have a lot of protocols that we currently have are due to lawsuits like this, right? So I understand it. I think that you're right, though, that this is, you know, really subject to a subjective interpretation of what the word wholesome means. There's no standard definition of wholesome. It's one thing if you're, you know, as was alleged in our prior story, that, you know, tests show that you're actually including much more calories and fat than advertised. That's quantifiable. That's not subjective. Calling it wholesome, I mean, I do think it's, if there is, you know, all this industrial chemicals in there and mold, it's a little tough to call that healthy and wholesome, but, you know, that's really a speculative and subjective term, in my opinion. Brian?
You know, I'm not so sure that this is misleading. Nature's Bakery does not necessarily imply that these are natural ingredients. When you use the term wholesome, I'm thinking something that your mother, your grandmother may have made. I don't know the recipes. Maybe that's a good thing. So I'm not necessarily convinced that this actually is, you know, deceptive or false advertising. I'm sure as heck not going to be trying one of these bars anytime soon.
Yeah, I like my mold more visible. Hey, Chris, I mean, if I was defending this case, the one question I would ask the plaintiff, it was like, hey, stupid, do you think that it was actually baked by nature? Like, the very title of it implies that maybe it's just a advertising term. It wasn't made by Mother Nature in a bakery. It's a product that was made in a factory. Caveat emptor. Let the buyer beware, right? I mean, come on.
Well, I mean, read the label, too. But, I mean, the thing that bothers me the most about this is the sugar. I mean, like, adding that much sugar, you know, is to me the most thing that's most dangerous to the consumer. But, you know, it's funny. I saw something, Rich, about Canada, about French fries that we love from a certain fast food place. And in Canada, they use three ingredients. It's potatoes, oil, and salt. And in the United States, those same fries have more chemicals than a set of tires. So, like, these words mean nothing. Wholesome means nothing. Healthy means nothing. And that's the problem.
By the way, Rich, raisins are baked by nature. Raisins.
That's right. And those little guys that come out of the packet to the tune of the...
Absolutely. All right. Marvin Gaye. A German man ate a New York taco, and now he's seeking $20 million in damages. Rich, fill out this story for us.
I mean, this poor guy, I really feel bad for him, and I do feel bad for all his damages that he incurred. Maybe he should get $10 million that he's alleging, because he went to New York. Imagine the world we're living in, that he had a taco, and Tina, he put some salsa on it by his own choice, right? He wasn't held down by a team of New Yorkers and forced to induce this taco with salsa. He ate the salsa and he said, quote, "My tongue and mouth were burning immediately. My Apple Watch registered a higher pulse." Well, Tina, that led to him filing a lawsuit in the Southern District of New York, claiming that the restaurant he purchased these tacos at failed to warn him of the hot salsa. In that case, he sought $100,000 in damages. But that wasn't the end of it. He also sued Tina for this fateful visit to New York because he was in the U.S. for 4 days. Then he, again, I know this is a shock to our consciousness, he went to Walmart in Secaucus, not far from Fusco, and he couldn't get Wi-Fi. And, of course, that trauma resulted in distress for him. And that led to him suing Walmart for, guess how much? $10 million for psychosomatic and post-traumatic symptoms. So you feel bad for the guy. I just write him a check today and give him all that money he's asking for. That was a very traumatic visit. I mean, listen, anyone who goes to New Jersey should be automatically given $1 million for any trauma they suffer, because New Jersey is crazy. But
stay home. You know. Don't come here.
Yeah, just stay home.
Yeah, stay home.
We don't want you.
So I know first the taco all, place he went to. It's very good.
Yeah. First of all, I want to sue him for the trauma that article inflicted on my eyeballs being written in one paragraph. Like, seriously, my eyes hurt afterwards. Second of all, I feel like someone just dared him to do this. And he heard that, us Americans that were very litigious. So why not visit our country and see how litigious we can be? And, you know, he probably wanted 15 minutes, you know, of fame, and he got it. We're talking about him on Legal Face Off. So, you know, and he had an article written about him. So there you have
it. I love the fact, like Tina said, Fusco, that in Germany, like, you'd probably be thrown in jail for bringing this kind of stupid ass lawsuit. But this guy comes to Germany, all his buddies are like, "Hey, go to Walmart. I hear you could get no Wi-Fi and sue."
But look, there's a lot of things to sue the caucus for. Having no Wi-Fi probably isn't one of them. I mean, if you said he grew a third eye or something like that, then maybe I believe him. But stay home. By the way, it's important to note that he brought his cases pro se. No lawyer would take him. Don't come here. Just stay home.
And my apology to all the Germans for Rich's accent there. We'll work on it. This one's
wait till
a
you hear my
amusing.
Wait till you hear my Irish.
Yeah, here we go.
It's gonna be a long day. Yeah.
Yeah. Tina's got the top St. Patrick's Day lawsuits for us. Tina, take it away.
So, as our listeners here on LFO know, we love to celebrate holidays and even have our podcasts on holidays to talk about all the fun lawsuits that tend to get filed in connection with holidays. And Rich, I don't know if we've ever even done a St. Patrick's Day lawsuit recap, have we?
We haven't, but you know what? I like it too.
I don't even know what that accent is.
We're all four Guinnesses
sue
in
you
right
for
now,
me.
Yeah.
I'm going to sue you for that accent. So anyway, so we've got some really interesting cases here. As oftentimes happens, they fall into buckets. There's usually paraphernalia associated with a holiday that ends up being misused. In this case, we have a woman who decided that she was going to sue because she was in a parade where people were throwing cabbage that knocked her down and caused injuries requiring several surgeries. So we've got that. And then we've got always, you know, the holiday parties where bad things happen, especially when they're thrown at work. And of course, there are many sexual harassment lawsuits coming out of St. Patrick's Day you know, celebrations, because they often include alcohol. So for me, the personal favorite, I'd love to hear from our panel, but for me, the personal favorite is the cabbage lawsuit. I mean, you just can't be suing people over having a, you know, cabbage thrown at you.
Yeah, this was, this woman was claimed that she was struck in the face by a cabbage, knocked her down. I don't know, how would you pinpoint the defendant in that, right? I mean, if you've seen any of the Chicago St. Paddy's Day, or this was Connecticut, I mean, there's literally thousands of drunk people, but that's a good one. I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, dram shop lawsuits that you always see. We talked earlier about offline about, I'm sure environmental groups have sued the city of Chicago for dyeing the river green, even though it's supposed to be environmental friendly. But the funny thing about this holiday is most of the stories that we covered, unlike, you know, the variety of stories in our Halloween episodes or Christmas, these mostly involve people being struck in the head by something.
Can you assume the risk on St. Patrick's Day of being hit by flying cabbage? I think that's probably fair.
Yeah. Or flying leprechauns, right? Leprechaun tossing?
You know, so many.
Well, let's end the show with a question going around the horn and ask our esteemed panel the following question. Maybe we'll do this one, actually. Besides leprechauns and besides lawsuits, what's your favorite thing about St. Patrick's Day? If you had to pick one thing, Ryan Burrow, about St. Patrick's Day that you enjoy, or Irish people in general, what would that be?
I would say the alcohol. I don't, is that good enough, or do I gotta break it down to Guinness? I suppose
that was you, Kara. What are those jugs called again?
The Blorg.
Yeah.
What
does it stand for?
I don't know what it stands for. Something I'll look it up, Chris and Brian. You might be aware of this. I don't. It's been filling up my feed. These young people who bring this, like, it's like a milk jug of alcohol, but it's dyed. And yeah. They bring it down to the parade and they stupidly drink it and just get hammered and wasted. And the police just grab it. I encourage you to look it up. It's hilarious.
It's a whole thing, Brian. What's your favorite part of St. Patrick's Day, or Irish people in general?
31 years ago today, I met my wife at Otis's on St. Patrick's Day.
Nice.
That's my favorite thing. At our wedding, we toasted with a green beer, and so we'll probably do that later on tonight when I get home.
Nice.
That's a good one.
I'll just say, as 100% Italian, it's my half Irish wife and my Gaelic and garlic kids that I have are my favorite parts of
garlic. Wow, we're going sentimental on this episode.
Yeah.
No one said Lucky Charms yet. Yeah,
I didn't do The Sopranos. You know, hell is Irish bar and St. Patrick's Day every day. I didn't do that.
Tina, favorite thing about the Irish or St. Patty's?
Irish Spring.
Good smell.
Good smell.
Speaking of bad accents.
All right, Lisa.
I got to say the bagpipes. This is the only time of the year that I can handle the bagpipes.
Yeah, it's a good one.
I can't handle lucky charms. Them ever.
So
I'm
we
married
talked
an Irishman.
Well, we talked about Springsteen. I've seen Springsteen many times, but guess who the band that I've seen the second most of all time is? Newsflash, it'll be U2. I'm a big U2 fan. I can't tell the difference between ABC News, Hill Street Blues, and the preacher on the old time gospel hour. The God I believe in doesn't require cash, mister. Am I booging you? I don't mean to bug you. Yeah, it'll be U2.
There we go. Very good. By the way, Brian, Chris, and Rich, you're all getting pinched. Lisa, I'm assuming that you're wearing green today, right?
I am.
All right. You, Tina, and I are in the car. Oh, he does have green pants on. All right.
Actually, I'm wearing green pants too.
Oh, green pants.
The other shade of green. The brown shade of green.
The question is, what's Ziggy wearing?
Oh yeah. Does Ziggy have a green outfit? Wait, do you paint Ziggy green and then head down to the parade? Do you do that?
Ziggy's off. Ziggy's still working off the weekend. He's drunk. He's a little hungover.
He got into that blorg.
Yeah.
All right. Let's wrap this up. Thank you so much, Christopher Fusco and Brian Rosenblatt. That'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Face Off on WGN. I want to give a thanks to Chicago Inspector General Deborah Witzberg. We won't be able to call her that much longer. Eugene Volokh, Thomas Seibel Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and Diana Winters, Deputy Director of the Resnick Center for Food Law and Policy at UCLA Law. Also, shout out to Ben Anderson. Saw him today. He's wearing green. Lisa Stegall, she's wearing green. Tina Martini wearing green. Rich Lindcuff wearing green. I'm wearing green. Ryan Breaux, thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lindcoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget.